The government took a swipe at global internet giants on Monday, suggesting rules that would require companies to proactively remove content the government views as illegal or harmful, and giving the government the right to block or even shut down offending sites. As part of the Online Harms White Paper, a joint proposal from the Department for Digital Culture, Media and Sport and the Home Office, a new independent regulator will be introduced to ensure companies meet their responsibilities. The proposals, contained in a 102-page white paper, are aimed at combating the spread of disinformation, hate speech, online extremism, and child exploitation. If enacted, as described, they would constitute some of the most stringent and far-reaching restrictions on internet speech by a major Western democracy. Critics say the proposals fail to balance curbing harmful speech with free expression. No matter how well-meaning, opponents of the white paper argue that the proposals to regulate the web could give the state the power to clamp down on the freedom of the press and free speech. This at a time, of course, when Britain is criticising violations of freedom of expression in states like Iran, China, and Russia. Should we really, critics argue, be undermining such freedoms at home? It also means that the same rules that govern behemoths such as Google and Facebook, both of which have expert in-house legal teams and billions of pounds at their disposal, will apply to any website, however small or harmless, that allow users to post comments. Such regulation aimed at nudging the behaviour of tech giants will actually entrench their position as market leaders by stifling innovation and competition. I'm Darren Grimes, and joining me to discuss is the IEA Senior Counsel Victoria Hewson and Matthew Lesh of the Adam Smith Institute. Hello to both of you.
Hi, Darren.
Hi.
Now, I want to start by asking you, Matthew, surely the Home Secretary is right to ensure that companies that allow users to post or share content online should be required to proactively police content that the UK government deems illegal. I mean, surely you wouldn't accept child sexual exploitation and abuse, the sale of illegal goods, or terrorist activity being viewed online.
Look, I think it's relatively uncontroversial that there are certain illegal activities that no legal online internet company should sanction or allow on their platform. What I think that this white paper does, though, is it really fundamentally changes the arrangements for really what is liability on these platforms, for what it means for them to be able to have user-generated content. One of the key underlying principles of the internet, both in the European Union as well as in the United States, is what's called platform liability exemptions, which means that the platforms aren't responsible for the content posted by the users, which means that they can basically exist. Because imagine if Facebook had to read everyone's comments before they were posted because they could get sued for what you say. It would make the platform completely unviable. So it's a key principle that when things are reported, they have responsibility to remove them, but they shouldn't be retrospectively liable for the activities of their users. I think what this white paper does is change that legal arrangement quite fundamentally by calling for fines, putting out jail time for senior executives, about blocking websites, some quite extreme sanctions and overreach in the what they're trying to do here.
Victoria?
That's right. And this follows hot on the heels of the Copyright Directive, which essentially chips away in the same way the platform providers' safe harbour for copyright infringement that had previously shielded them from liability for infringing content posted by users. So that was what was in the famous Article 13 of the Copyright Directive. So now platform operators will not only have to be on their guard and potentially liable for copyright infringement by their users, this new policy will extend that to myriad other potential infringements, both illegal activities and actually perfectly legal activities that the government just doesn't like. Mm. And I should add as well that although somewhat now unlikely, we won't be an EU member when the Copyright Directive comes in. True to form, our government, the UK government, supported the Copyright Directive. Mm-hmm. So unless there's a major change of government policy in the meantime, it looks like they will actually implement the Copyright Directive changes to the law for platforms and follow it up with our own homegrown new regulation for online harms.
I mean, the Home Secretary, Victoria, came out and defended or tried to defend his paper on Twitter by making the point that actually he does believe in free speech. And actually, I think a lot of people listening at home would probably think he's been quite sensible by believing that you don't have the freedom to post beheading videos or child sex abuse. And the paper doesn't go much beyond that, does it?
It goes massively beyond that, unfortunately. And the Home Secretary was, let's charitably say, selective in choosing the examples of extreme terrorism and child sexual exploitation. In fact, ironically, the paper, the policy white paper, also covers areas like, dare I say, misinformation. And
you might very well think that.
And harassment and abuse of public figures, which, you know, is very convenient for public figures who feel under siege for making poor policy decisions, clearly want to defend themselves from being abused online. Now, as you know, as we've already said, if an activity is illegal, of course the police should be taking action against such illegal activity. But this white paper very much blurs the boundaries between illegal activities and what it even specifically describes as legal but harmful behaviours, mm-hmm. Presumably such legal but perceived harmfulness to be determined from time to time by a regulator.
Matthew?
So what's fascinating about the paper is at many points it doesn't just talk about illegal content, it talks about, and I quote directly, unacceptable content, which is a very moralizing statement. And then it goes on to list topics like misinformation, like intimidation, like cyberbullying, sexist abuse, or violent content. A lot of these things don't have clear legal definitions that mean it is illegal. And I think a good case of this is this discussion within the paper about what is hate speech. So it talks about non-illegal offensive material in its list of hateful content. I mean, it just raises so many questions about offensive to who, what, when. The nature of offensive speech is that it's very much something that's often in the eyes of the beholder, and it's a very low standard from a free speech perspective about what kind of things would be allowable online. And the government's almost proud of itself that it's putting terrorism in with misinformation, in with even log sections in there about over screen time usage by underage people.
How long,
like, all these things are the same.
Sleep patterns for children is referred to in that.
Yeah, they're basically saying they're just trying to mix everything together and creating a kind of moral equivalence and then necessarily a similar duty on tech companies, and not even just tech companies, but any company with an online presence, to follow this list of what is unacceptable, which seems completely disproportionate.
The paper, Victoria, is notably thin on how it intends to fund this all-powerful regulator. Whether it augments Ofcom or creates an entirely new body. And I mean, despite algorithms catching harmful content more often, you know, Facebook, Google, YouTube, they're all at it. For a regulator to stay ahead, it would need serious resource because you still need humans actually doing the work.
That's right. And one of the things that this paper calls for consultation responses on is what form this new regulator should take. Although it's very keen to reassure us that this regulator will be duly, suitably resourced and expert enough to tackle this hugely wide-ranging...
It's amazing. I can read the future almost. Yeah.
Yeah. And interestingly, they talk about using technology and using algorithms to ensure content is acceptable, I suppose, which is interesting because one of the things that it also wants to tackle is use of algorithms. So apparently some algorithms are bad and we don't like them and the regulator wants to eliminate them. But some algorithms are good because they're algorithms that filter out misinformation and abusive content and they're good algorithms. And this new regulator, of course, will be suitably resourced to know the difference. But you're quite right. Who's going to pay for it? Well, ultimately, we all will, whether that's directly through taxpayer central government funding or whether it's because in the way that is now the case with the Data Protection Regulator, the Information Commissioner's Office is funded by a levy on data controllers who have to pay an annual fee for the privilege of being regulated. Now, who ultimately bears the cost of all of these new additional levies? Of course, it is the consumer and the user of those services.
And actually, Victoria, one of the main criticisms against the Information Commissioner's Office is that actually it hasn't really... it can't keep up with modern technologies and all the rest of it. So how can this new regulator be expected to do that?
Well, this is one of my concerns about a lot of these regulators who have immense powers and responsibilities over huge areas of the economy and actually life in general. So the Information Commissioner is a great example where it has massive powers, the data protection, the General Data Protection Regulation and our Data Protection Act are so wide-ranging that no company could ever hope to be fully compliant with all of it, never mind every company and every data processor or controller in the country. Therefore, by definition, these regulators have to be selective in their enforcement. Now, in slightly euphemistically, the white paper here talks about proportionate and risk-based enforcement, which I must say I read as discretionary and arbitrary, determined by the regulator as to who they want to go after.
Matthew, what impact is this going to have on the marketplace of platforms and tech providers? Do you think this entrenches global giants like Facebook?
Look, I think that's certainly a very big risk with this regulation. Mark Zuckerberg said himself last year when addressing the US Congress that large tech companies like himself can deal with the cost of regulation. It's the smaller tech startups that struggle. Meanwhile, just last week, Mark Zuckerberg came out in the Washington Post and said, well, he's happy to be regulated. He's happy for the industry to be regulated. And that's really because it creates competitive advantages for Facebook. They're the ones who can afford to develop the algorithms, to hire the thousands upon thousands of moderators. One thing I really worry about is the government talks a lot about how it wants competition. In fact, they just did the Fairman competition review where they're trying to get more competition in the tech space. And that's with one hand. And with the other hand, they're coming forward and they're saying, we're going to have this massive new bits of regulation. Mm-hmm. And there's even been some polling to suggest that investors in tech companies will be substantially less likely to invest in competitors to Facebook or Twitter if they know that there's substantial regulatory costs and liability on them when for things that people post. So really, ultimately, all this red tape is going to do, like we know all red tape does, is entrench big players who are involved with the creation of regulation, who have got relationships with the regulator. In this case, they're going to be funding the regulator, creating some quite concerning relationships potentially. So you're going to get this kind of cartel policymaking process that we've seen in so many other areas coming online, which is very disappointing since tech was supposed to be the realm of startups. And I think that's going to necessarily struggle and suffer under these kind of regulations.
We've already seen the exact scenario happening when the GDPR came in. Lots of international companies just exited the EU market completely because the compliance burden and the risk of non-compliance, they just didn't have the appetite for that. So lots of, for example, US news publishers have just geo-blocked their sites from the EU market. And frankly, I can see the same thing happening with this. We are fragmenting the internet and potentially cutting ourselves off from new and interesting innovative providers that will be able to start up in the US, which it looks like is one of the few countries left that actually will respect free speech on the internet.
Does this only apply to social media, Matthew?
Well, unfortunately not. So Although it will apply and it is being targeted at the big tech companies, the scope of these regulations are actually extraordinarily broad. What they're saying is it will apply to anyone, anywhere where you communicate with each other online, potentially both in public communications, think like Twitter or Facebook or news website comment sections or reviews on TripAdvisor, but also even on top of that, this part of the consultation is about when they define a private conversation. So it's very high likelihood that group chats could come under this regulatory system. So you're thinking if you have a group chat of 20 people in WhatsApp, the government could consider that to be a public enough platform in which they need to be able to intrude and ensure this duty of care on the platforms. And there's a serious danger to privacy, to the encryption that's built into these kind of applications that's designed to mean that people can't see what you're saying, or at least intermediaries can't see what you're saying. So this is quite scary, the scope of this, that really no one will be left behind in these regulations as they're currently intended.
No, it specifically will apply to messaging services and file hosting sites, by which I assume they mean things like Dropbox.
Yes.
Wasn't there a massive pushback, though, Victoria, sort of at this kind of legislation where, you know, they've tried to make WhatsApp drop their encryption, so, you know, create a way around the back door in order to tackle terrorism, isn't it? I mean, you can see what they're trying to do. It's well-intentioned.
Well, I think what they're trying to do potentially is quite clever from a tactical perspective, which is to push through all of this really intrusive legislation around private communications and non-criminal things that are deemed to be unacceptable or harmful by coupling that together with very repellent illegal activities like terrorism and child sexual exploitation. You can wave it all through and critics can be safely written off as people who just don't care about all of these terrible things, which is, you know, which is quite worrying. I would also argue in a way it's the state actually delegating responsibilities for things that the state should be taking responsibility for. If crimes are being committed, surely that's a matter for policing to, you know, to investigate and prosecute these crimes rather than outsource its responsibilities and ultimately place the liability onto technology companies.
Matthew, Twitter said in response to the paper that it will continue to engage in the discussion between industry and the UK government, as well as work to strike an appropriate balance between keeping users safe and preserving the internet's open, free nature. Now, just how at risk do you think that open, free nature actually is?
Look, I think this proposal represents a serious danger, not just in the list of what's in it, which in itself are quite limiting on free speech. But I also worry that once you create a regulatory structure that you have the powers to tell a social media companies what they are and aren't allowed to say, it is just asking to be taken advantage of and expanded in future. So once you create a system of state censorship, you have a serious, serious danger for free speech, even more broadly in the future, and a real loss of legitimacy of Britain saying that we are a liberal democratic country that upholds free speech principles.
It's a bit extreme, Victoria. What do you think?
I think, unfortunately, this is very much what this white paper sets us on path towards. It talks about things like ensuring the accuracy and quality of news output and other, you know, extremely paternalistic and actually quite snobbish things that are trying to redirect individuals away from all of this, you know, nasty, untrustworthy news content that they're having their heads turned by, and have some kind of regulatory intervention to improve the quality of what people are reading on the internet, which is just horribly paternalistic, nannying behaviour.
There are other measures, Matthew, and I wonder if you've thought of any yourself that, as an alternative to this white paper, improving free speech protections to permit data sharing between us and the US, for example, or banning under 13s from use of social media altogether, which some have argued would be more effective in preventing serious crime than this.
Look, I think particularly the idea of more data sharing between crime agencies is quite an effective way to target people. What you find online is that it's both an opportunity for people to do illegal and bad things, but also to expose themselves to being caught. So, for example, in American law, one of the worrying things they differentiate freedom was to ban sites where people were soliciting prostitution. Now, that seemed like a good idea at the time, but what in fact it led to was that prostitutes couldn't share information as well on potential dangerous men, and it's potentially increased their danger quite substantially. So when you have these things online, it is an opportunity to track and watch it closely if you properly data share and you pay attention to it closely. At the same time, I think to some extent, we have to get our heads out of this kind of the role of government is to bubble wrap us from any kind of harms that might potentially exist. The reality is the internet is a fantastic place that lets us share and access information, communicate, develop new ideas. It is also a place where there are dangers, where there are potential harms that can be caused. You can't get rid of all those harms. You can't get rid of all danger online. Realistically, even this white paper won't do that. It'll just push it into the dark web and untrackable places. So you've got to an extent, say to yourself, there is some acceptable, and I'm thinking like an economist here, if you just completely got rid of the internet, you get rid of all instant harm. Unfortunately, when you have these kind of technologies, sometimes it will be used for harmful purposes. Let's respond to those things when they do happen. Let's not overreact in kind of this moral panic we're seeing at the moment, driven by certain activities that are, I think, leading to some quite totalitarian implications for policymaking.
Victoria?
No, I agree. And I think, speaking of misinformation, I think calling this process the establishment of a duty of care is itself quite misleading, because it's sort of piggybacking on an established legal concept, the duty of care that sort of attaches to individuals in their interactions with each other, that can give rise to tortious liability for things like negligence. This is not that. This does not include any of the requirements that would usually be necessary to give rise to a duty of care and to liability for breaching the duty of care. Now, I think had a serious legal proposal been put forward that genuinely sought to develop the law of tort and negligence in a direction where you could actually attach liability to social media platforms if there had been a genuine breach of a duty of care as we would traditionally have understood it, that would have been quite interesting. Similarly, perhaps devising a new criminal offence of accessory liability where a platform operator or technology provider was genuinely facilitating and effectively being an accessory to criminal activity, that again would have been a much more interesting and probably proportionate response to this. As it is, it feels like basically policing and law enforcement has not kept up with the advances in communications technology and the internet. And in fact, it might have been much more useful to invest in updating policing practices so the police are better resourced to actually investigate and prosecute these online crimes.
In a sentence, sum up how you feel about the online harms white paper.
I'm extremely concerned that this white paper will undermine the liberal democratic freedoms which Britain has so historically upheld. And as a consequence, really, I'm quite disappointed by it.
I share Matthew's concerns. I think the only hope is that this policy white paper will not progress further towards actually being legislated.
Thank you very much, Victoria and Matthew.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you.
Now, what do you think? Serious risk to an open, free internet, or a sensible measure to protect British internet users? Let me know on our Twitter handle, IEA London. And for more podcasts, films, and reports, you can visit the IEA website at iea.org.uk.